Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we continue our Africans Rising series. We speak with Senegal-based Kumba Touré, a leading change maker in the areas of social entrepreneurship and youth educational development. And the latest news on the ground in Venezuela as the crisis there deepens with journalist and political analyst Lucas Koerner. This year marks the 75th anniversary of the Japanese internment in the United States. We discuss this, the implications, what happened then, and lessons learned for today. Our guests are Bill Watanabe, Executive Director of the Little Tokyo Service Center in Los Angeles, and historian Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. FBI Director James Comey faces hours of questioning from a Senate committee today. He's bound to be asked about the Bureau's investigation into potential coordination between President Donald Trump's election campaign and Russia. Trump took to Twitter late yesterday to say, quote, the phony Trump-Russia story was an excuse used by the Democrats as justification for losing the election. Trump spoke after former Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton pointed to Comey as a major factor in her loss.
It wasn't a perfect campaign. There is no such thing. But I was on the way to winning until the combination of Jim Comey's letter on October 28th and Russian WikiLeaks raised doubts in the minds of people who were inclined to vote for me but got scared off.
Clinton said if the election had been held October 27th, she would have won. Comey made public a letter on October 28th informing Congress the FBI had reopened a probe of Clinton's use of a private email server as Secretary of State. The Comey letter was contrary to longstanding Justice Department and FBI practices to not comment publicly about politically sensitive investigations within 60 days of an election. The police chief of the suburban Dallas town of Balch Springs has fired the officer who shot and killed a black 15-year-old boy riding in a vehicle leaving a party Saturday night. Chief Jonathan Haber said the officer was terminated for violating department policies in the shooting death of Jordan Edwards.
The investigation is complete. After reviewing the findings, I have made the decision to terminate Roy Oliver, employment with the Balch Springs Police Department. You have my assurances. My department will continue to be responsive, transparent, and accountable.
The high school freshman was leaving the party with his two brothers and two other teens Saturday night. Police had arrived at the scene to investigate an underage drinking complaint and spotted the vehicle leaving. The officer opened fire as the teens were driving away. The Dallas County Medical Examiner ruled Edwards' death a homicide. Family members say they want criminal charges filed against the officer. Developments in two other high-profile cases that involve police killings of African-American men. In the first, fired North Charleston police officer Michael Slager pled guilty to a civil rights violation for shooting in the back unarmed black motorist Walter Scott as he ran away following a traffic stop. Slager likely faces prison time under the terms of his plea deal. The deal averts another trial. Slager's first trial on murder charges ended in a hung jury. In another case, the Justice Department reportedly has decided not to charge two white Baton Rouge, Louisiana police officers in the shooting death of Alton Sterling. Sterling was sitting outside a convenience store selling CDs when confronted by police who first hit him with a stun gun and then shot him after officers said they saw a gun in his pants pocket and claimed he tried to reach for it before he was shot. Protesters gathered outside the convenience store where Sterling was shot last night. The self-styled Islamic State group is claiming responsibility for a suicide car bomb attack against a U.S. military convoy in the Afghan capital. The blast killed at least 8 Afghan civilians and wounded 3 U.S. service members. Amnesty International says more than 250,000 people have signed an online petition urging Turkey to release about 120 journalists who were jailed following last summer's failed coup. The petition also calls on Turkey to end its ruthless crackdown on freedom of expression. California could be moving toward using 100% green energy to generate electricity by the year 2045. It's another step in California's move to address climate change by reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Christopher Martinez reports.
Senate President Pro Tem Kevin De Leon wants California's electricity grid to abandon fossil fuels like natural gas and to shift to only renewable or zero carbon energy over the next 3 decades.
Today, we announce an important next step in California's climate leadership. Senate Bill 100 puts California on the path to 100% clean energy, renewable energy, by 2045. It's the most ambitious target in the world.
SB 100 would direct California's Air Resources Board, Public Utilities Commission, and Energy Commission to adopt policies to reach total reliance on renewable energy and zero carbon resources by 2045. Backers say this would come as the Trump administration seems to be moving in the opposite direction. Senator Scott Wiener is a Democrat from San Francisco.
As the federal government, whether it's around immigration or health care or energy, tries to go backwards and to tear down the progress we made, we move forward.
On the State Capitol Beat, I'm Christopher Martinez.
I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are continuing our Africans Rising series today, and I'd like to welcome our guest, Kumba Touré. Kumba, originally from Mali and based in Senegal, is a leading change maker in the areas of social entrepreneurship and youth educational development. Her activism includes writing children's books as tools to build a community that supports young people in creating their own learning tools and social change projects. Kumba Touré also works to develop leadership among girls and young women. She has facilitated hundreds of educational workshops around the world on gender, race, economic justice, advocacy. Kumba Touré currently works with Global Social Entrepreneurship Organization, Ashoka, serving as its representative for the Sahel region. Kumba Touré, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. It's so great to be on the radio with you.
Now, Kumba, I'd like to focus. You do quite a lot of work with girls and young women. But first, I'd like you to define for us, what is social entrepreneurship?
Well, from a shorter point of view, we go from the idea that wherever there are problems, there are people looking for solutions, acting on them and inspired to make change, that we don't need to go very far from where problems and the issues are in the main communities where those problems are. There are many people who are working. So for 30 years, Ashoka has been really proposing social entrepreneurship, looking at people who look for solutions to social problems, using an entrepreneurial mind and creative mind to find those solutions. So thousands of them are supported to the Ashoka Fellowship. But the real idea is that everyone, every single person, could be a change maker, and that together, when people come together, they could really make a difference.
Right. Okay. So basically, social entrepreneurship, what I gather then, are people working together to make change. Would that
Make change, Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Yeah, it's important to kind of spell out these terms in a language that the average person could understand. Sometimes we, you know, especially large non-governmental organizations have kind of these inside type phrases that are not necessarily known.
You're right.
Here. And that's part of the problem, isn't it? Kind of breaking down things on the grassroots level. So Kumba Touré, before we discuss a bit more about women and girls, the work you are part of, Africans Rising, is that it? That network that's being launched?
Right. I've been nominated and invited to be an ambassador to Africans Rising, which is also a movement of Africans and African organizations on the continent and in the diaspora of people who say, you know, that we can work together for peace, for justice, and for dignity, that we will not just anymore wait for any government or businesses to make a difference, but that people can come together and make change. Of course, there are many, many organizations already working, but the idea is to connect the work and to show what is possible when we come together.
Yeah, my understanding is it is a movement also for African unity. Is that right?
Exactly. It is Africans all over the continent and in the diaspora come together to solve the problems that they're facing.
Right. And then how do you see the work that you are doing with girls and women in the context of the broader goals of Africans Rising?
I believe that my contribution to that movement comes from the actions that I've been already taking. Many of them concerning young women and concerning women. Already on the continent, there are many, many African women rising, organizing for their rights, but also organizing to make a difference in different fields, whether it's around environmental issues or economic, you know, issues. And that's on the continent, and that's in the diaspora. So to me, bringing that work, those connections to this movement, and making sure that as we come together, as a Pan-African movement for peace, justice, and dignity, that the issues that women and young women particularly face are not, put on the side, but also that the young women are seen as drivers of change and can see their own role in making the difference.
Right. Well, we certainly know in most parts of the world where there are social movements happening, and there are social movements just about happening everywhere, wherever there is oppression. We have to assume that people are, in fact, resisting in some way. And we often find that women are at the forefront of this. Now, in terms of women on the continent of Africa, Africa being the wealthiest continent, I think, in terms of minerals and natural resources in the world, but yet the most impoverished in the world. And the workload of African women on the continent is just tremendous. And a lot of that has to do with poverty, with, you know, lack of resources, lack of access. And there's also a big a division between resources that go to larger NGOs, non-governmental organizations that are supposed to be uplifting the base. We certainly see that in places like Haiti and other parts of the Americas where that actually does not happen. So then talk about your work in terms of your work specifically with women and overcoming some of these challenges, including that tremendous burden of work.
I think one part of our work, my work, is to defy the invisibility that surrounds women in general, and of course young women in particular. When you talk about the contributions to the movement, the work that is done, you know, whether it's in the house or in the organizations or even in formal settings, it is most of the time not seen, not recognized, even though it's very it contributes to the wealth of the whole community and to the care of the whole community. So I could go into example, but really one of the celebration work that we do is called Invisible Giants Celebration, where young women can nominate and look around for women in the communities who are doing great work for those communities, making change happen, allowing, you know, young girls to go to school or helping for changes to happen in the community, making sure that work gets visible, gets celebrated, and that more young women get inspired to be engaged and do that work.
Right. And, you know, for those of us, I'm of African descent, and, you know, in the diaspora, there is a tendency to romanticize in a way, because so much of the culture of our roots in Africa have been stripped from us, that there is that tendency to romanticize in a way African culture, and really not wanting to confront some of the problems that may be there in some societies, for example, confronting sexism, misogyny, you know, homophobia, you know, domestic violence and that sort of thing. I don't know if you know what I mean.
Exactly. And that needs to be faced, and we face it, and we work on it. And we are saying that, you know, patriarchy, whether those action comes from, you know, actions that have been there for a long time and now are set up almost as, you know, tradition, or whether it comes from colonial traditions. What we see is many times that there are from different sources, and whether it comes from different religions, but there are different ways in which women are, you know, put in the back or the side or just exploited or violated. That it doesn't matter where it comes from, we will fight it, and we will name it, and it will create our own, you know, traditions, if needed, that respect women.
Right. And, you know, the whole thing about, you know, I know you work in the area of education, educating girls and young women, and you write children's books, you know, and more. And I'm wondering how you see the impact, and this may be more so in the countryside than in the cities, but perhaps in the cities as well, where, for example, if you have women who have to walk who knows how far, you know, to either collect wood or water, you know, for cooking, and then just, you know, that kind of basic survival work that impacts a woman's ability then to be active in her community or to be able to go to school. Or sometimes girls are taken out of school. I mean, even in my village where I grew up in, there were girls that had to leave school to be able to help out at home or help out working in the fields, just, you know, to help the family to survive. So how are you navigating that, and what are some of the things put in place to address those issues?
You are perfectly right. When people talk about poverty, you know, it needs to be broken down. And what does it actually mean? What it means most of the time at the end of the road is that there is somebody who doesn't have a choice about what they do of their time, of their life, of their physical force. Mm-hmm. That's what it means. And most of the time, it comes at the end, you know, on the shoulders of women and young women and, you know, of people who don't have, you know, the means, or people who are in the rural inside or don't have anybody connected, you know, to high level or to money. So that's really what it is about. So the fight really is about making sure that everyone has the same rights, the same opportunities, the same possibilities, and that's really how we fight poverty. That's how it should be.
Right, right. Well, there's certainly, Kumba Touré, a lot more to discuss on this topic. And I really hope that we can really, there's so much that we can't just do the Africa's Rising series in just a few segments. We are really going to have to expand on it a bit more. We're out of time now, but I do want to speak with you again and hope that you will be able to join us and continue this discussion, but also to remind our audience, and you could correct this if I'm wrong on this, Africans Rising is launching globally as a movement this African Liberation Day, is that right, which is May 25th, I understand?
Yes, mm-hmm. May 25th, all over the continent and in the diaspora, specifically on Gowe Island in Dakar, in Senegal. We are launching globally. And yes, I'm happy to come back and have more of a conversation with you on education, on women, on changes that are happening on the continent.
Right. Well, we appreciate you and your work and all involved in Africans Rising. We've been partnering with Africans Rising in this series. Kumba Touré, you hail from Mali. Is that right? You were raised in Mali?
Yes, from Mali. Mali, from Senegal, from, you know, the beautiful place.
Absolutely.
Where Timbuktu is, where the University of Sankore.
Yeah, well, we have to talk about all of that because so little is known about the continent. And so we thank you so very much for joining us, Kumba Touré.
Thank you.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And we are now going to turn our attention to Venezuela. What's going on? I mean, frankly speaking, what we're trying to do here is to bring some balance into the mainstream media's reporting of what's going on in Venezuela. Clearly, there is a crisis going on there, an economic crisis. The country is very divided at this point, and that has increased since the death of President Hugo Chavez, who was quite popular at the time of his death, and he was replaced by President Nicolas Maduro, who's really struggling right now. And there are few new developments in that crisis. Of course, mainstream media continues to paint Venezuela as hopeless and Maduro as a dictator and a repressor of peaceful protesters. And now he has proposed a new constitution and has also announced that Venezuela will leave the Organization of American States. Let's go to a few short clips now, one from Newsy and one from Al Jazeera on these topics.
After more than a month of anti-government protests and riots, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro said he wants to change the country's constitution. He called for the creation of a Constituent National Assembly, a new legislature that could rewrite the country's current constitution. That was crafted in 1999 by Hugo Chavez, the leader who turned Venezuela towards socialism by nationalizing the country's massive oil reserves. But opposition leaders say Maduro's announcement is a ruse to maintain power. On top of an economic crisis, the pro-Maduro Supreme Court dissolved the existing National Assembly, which the opposition controlled. Protesters are calling for new elections and for Maduro to step down. The president has called the protests a fascist coup. Opposition leaders say Maduro's plan to redraft the Constitution is a self-coup and say the president is dissolving democracy and dissolving our republic.
In Washington, the Organization of American States called for a Foreign Affairs Ministers meeting to discuss how best to deal with the crisis. But Caracas says the meeting is part of a Washington-led campaign against the government and has announced it will begin the 24-month process required to leave the organization.
Venezuela will not participate in any activity or events aiming to justify the interventionism of these countries that want to hurt Venezuela's peace and stability.
A political and economic crisis that for now has no end in sight.
All righty, there you go. And breaking news today. It's being reported by NBC, and I'm going to quote some of this report. An influential group of Republican and Democratic U.S. senators will file sweeping legislation on Wednesday, that is today, to address the crisis in Venezuela, including sanctioning individuals responsible for undermining democracy or involved in corruption, whatever that might mean. The bill, it is reported, would provide $10 million in humanitarian aid and require the State Department to coordinate a regional effort to ease the crisis and ask U.S. intelligence to report on the involvement of Venezuelan government officials in corruption and the drug trade. Now, this apparently Reuters has seen a copy of this. And it also calls on Trump to prevent Russia's state oil company from gaining control of any U.S. energy infrastructure. That is, Rosneft has been gaining ground in Venezuela. And so that is the connection with that. So really quite a lot going on. And the senators involved, of course, are Senator Marco Rubio, a Republican out of Florida, Senator John Cornyn of the Republicans, number two, Senator Dick Durbin, who's a Democrat, the number two Democrat, and Republican Senator John McCain. So this is from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So these are some new developments here. And I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Lucas Kerner, journalist and political analyst based in Caracas, Venezuela, currently a staff writer at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Lucas, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Okay, so Lucas, well, let's start here. Do you have a reaction now to this breaking news about this bill that's being proposed by a bipartisan group of senators targeting Venezuela?
It's very difficult to know where to begin with these things, but I think we can start with the fact that this is just a continuation of U.S. intervention with regard to Venezuela, that Obama already signed an executive decree in 2015, which he renewed two times, declaring Venezuela a national security threat, which was never really justified, how Venezuela would be a threat to U.S. national security. In March, in February, we saw Venezuela's vice president was sanctioned under the International Narcotics Kingpin Act by the U.S. Treasury Department, which is an unprecedented move that the highest ranking official in the world would be sanctioned in this way. Again, there has not been any evidence that he is linked to any drug cartels or drug trafficking, which is usually something you'd have to present in order to, evidence to actually bolster these claims. So this is clearly an escalation in which the Trump administration, U.S. Southern Command on April 6th or 7th, I believe, issued a statement also expressing concern for the situation in Venezuela, calling Venezuela a destabilizing factor in the region and alluding about potential intervention. And this was right 2 days before, on April 8th, that the protests really escalated. You saw an attack on the Venezuelan Supreme Court by hundreds of protesters. The death count now stands at 34. In fact, last night, we just saw two more people and eight more people were wounded in a bus that got into an accident because it was trying to avoid a barricade set up by opposition protesters. So, that puts the death count at 12 people who have been killed directly and indirectly by protesters, where five have been killed directly by police and the rest are unaccounted for. So, this is the real death count that we're seeing, yet the United States is talking about, human rights abuses and, the violations of the Constitution within Venezuela when, of course, one could only say that if these kinds of protests were happening in Washington or different cities in the United States and they were setting up violent barricades and they were besieging government institutions, that, we can only imagine what would be the response of the U.S. government to these protest.
Yeah, I actually saw some video of protesters walking up to government, clearly government security officers who had the riot shields in front of them and kind of spray painting and writing using, you know, on the shields to block the vision of the people behind it. And I was thinking, oh, my goodness. I mean, imagine if a protester in the United States, you know, tried to do something like that, you know, what would happen? They certainly would be beat down, you know, if not shot. But Lucas, also tell us about, because a lot is being made now, and of course, the mainstream media around the world being very critical of President Maduro, calling basically, it is portrayed as for the writing of a new constitution, calling for a national constituent assembly. And I'd like your view on that, because the constitution, that was a constitution that was hard fought for. 1999, I think it was, approved with President Hugo Chavez. And certainly the times I visited Venezuela when President Chavez was still alive, he always walked about with that constitution and Hola Presidente and everything. I mean, so many people had copies of the constitution when I went into impoverished areas. You know, the one book people would have would be the constitution. So what is the purpose now of a redraft of the Constitution? Is that what's going on?
Yes, I think that it's important to understand this is not just Maduro rewriting the Constitution. This is the convening of a constituent assembly, which will be conformed by 500 delegates. 250 will be directly elected by social movements, by workers, unions and organizations, feminist groups, communal councils and communes, LGBT movement, et cetera, representing, you know, the Venezuela's popular power. And the 250 will be local territorial leaders who will be likewise elected, though it has not been specified in what way this will take place.
Yeah, but why the need, though, for a new constitution? Because when the initial constitution was drafted, a lot of what you just described was also happened in terms of grassroots people organizing. And I know women were, you know, organizing and indigenous people, et cetera, to get their concerns reflected in the constitution. So why a need now for a new constitution?
I think the argument is the following, that, you know, while Venezuela's constitution in 1999 did, as you're absolutely right, come out of, you know, decades of struggle and serve to institutionalize those gains in many ways, though it was incomplete in a lot of senses. I can give you an example of the Afro-Venezuelan movement in Venezuela, which did not really succeed in institutionalizing its concerns in the same way that the indigenous community was able to. And however, in the last 18 years, you have seen important gains, particularly if we just take the example of the Afro-Venezuelan community, that you have an organic law against racial discrimination in the country, which was a massive victory. And that, you know, I think the bet on the part of Maduro and the part of many of the social movements is that, in fact, if they have the opportunity not to just rewrite, throw out the old constitution, but to draft a new document in the spirit of the 1999 constitution that goes further in institutionalizing many of the social visions, many of the new, you know, the communal councils, the institutions of grassroots power that are right as of now are parallel to the state, but to institutionalize them within the Magna Carta to further empower those instances. And I think that, you know, the question is more political. Is that Venezuela is in an impasse, a total standoff between the executive branch controlled by Maduro, the socialist elected socialist president, and the, you know, the opposition controlled parliament. And the only, you know, basically you've seen this kind of institutional jockeying and legalistic fighting for the, you know, really since the assembly came to power in January of 2016. So the question is, maybe this measure could be the way to throw open the field and actually, you know, allow the, you know, the movements to, from below, to come forward and resolve this crisis and push forward the, you know, consolidation and deepening of the revolutionary process. That would be, I would think, the calculation behind it. And one can certainly be skeptical of this, you know, in the sense that, I mean, clearly there is a risk that you end up delegitimizing the Constitution of 1999. And, you know, that is really the basis of this government's legitimacy. And that would be a very great weakness and, you know, problem. But I think that it's important to underline that this is completely, there's nothing illegitimate about calling for a constituent assembly. In fact, it's probably one of the most democratic right things that you can do to call to refound, you know, for the people to rewrite the Constitution of the country. In fact, so the very same opposition that is, you know, criticizing this, particularly Freddy Gulata, who's the vice president of the National Assembly, he, in 2014, called for a constituent assembly. Maria Corina Machado, another far-right leader of the Vente Venezuela Party, called for a constituent assembly. Leopoldo Lopez, who is currently in prison for leading 2014 violent protests, also called for a constituent assembly. So, I mean, it's very hypocritical to, you know, you can disagree with, you know, disagree with it, but it's a legitimate measure. And, you know, I think that it should be applauded that, you know, they're actually going to the people to decide Venezuela's future, and there actually will be general elections on every level after that happens, necessarily.
Yeah, and what about then the Organization of American States? I mean, a lot of people living in the United States, I mean, see a very, you know, the OAS, as it's known, as very positive, and why would Venezuela want to withdraw from the OAS? I mean, the experience certainly that I have had with the OAS, I mean, I saw certainly what they did in Haiti, for example, really in being part of the process that removed the coup against the democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and also in very questionable, fraudulent recent presidential elections held there, including the most recent one, electing Jovenel Moïse as president there, and in the previous one that in the end had to be thrown out because of the fraud, that the OAS was very, very quick to endorse the results. And they were also complicit in some ways with the coup that happened in Honduras against the democratically elected president Manuel Zelaya. And they folded under U.S. pressure to kind of, you know, recognize the coup government there. So that's some of the history people may not know about. So tell us why now, what has the OAS been doing to really force the hand of the Maduro government to withdraw from the OAS? And where is support coming from for the Maduro government now? Is there any regional support for the Maduro government? Lucas.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting to note that right as the Organization of American States is being convened by the United States to once again discuss the situation of Venezuela, that the CELAC, which is the Community of Latin American Caribbean States, which was formed at the initiative of Venezuela and with the support of many regional neighbors and conforms all 33 countries in the hemisphere, with the exception of the United States and Canada, just met in El Salvador yesterday and discussed the situation in Venezuela. And, you know, it seems that they have preparing to issue a statement supporting dialogue and condemning violence. So, I mean, there's just a very different type of conversation that's going on within the global south, within the countries, you know, within the countries to the south of the United States and Canada, you know, as opposed to the Organization of American States, which, you know, completely, one can argue, has violated many, you know, if you look at the record, violated many of its own prerogatives, in the sense that the head of that organization, Luis Almagro, himself, you know, when we saw earlier at the beginning of March, Bolivia assumed the presidency of the OAS, the rotating presidency, and they went ahead and, you know, and Bolivia rescheduled a session to discuss the situation in Venezuela because they had not followed the protocol for that. And, you know, they basically appointed Honduras as the interim president. There was basically a coup within the OAS. They appointed Honduras as the interim president and held the session anyway and released a statement without even a majority of the members present, basically calling for a restoration of the constitutional order in Venezuela, you know, which, of course, you know, without providing any evidence that it actually been broken.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is just the latest, the OAS, you know, Fidel Castro famously called the OAS, you know, the Ministry of Colonies of the United States. And I think that it's double standards. And, for example, when you compare the amount of time that Luis Almagro has spent criticizing Venezuela, which is a significant portion, people have done the math, I can't find it right now, a significant portion of his public statements and his Twitter statements have been dedicated to Venezuela, you know, I think like 10 times more than they have been dedicated to Brazil, you know, right, where there actually is a coup government in power, or, you know, you can take the case of Honduras, which is the most dangerous country for environmental activists, or Paraguay, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, clearly there are definitely reasons to be dubious of, you know, the statements coming from the OAS.
Right. Well, Lucas Kerner, I'm afraid we are out of time here. I mean, I definitely think that my personal view is definitely some dirty business going on in the part of the United States in relation to Venezuela. They've been trying to destabilize Chavismo from that coup attempt, failed coup attempt so many years ago, and still is at it. And it seems as though this new tactic of a new kind of coup is by starving people out, making the economy so difficult and people being so impoverished of really creating that kind of turmoil. But we'll continue this discussion, Lucas Kerner. We'll have you back and appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a good day.
All righty. We're going to take a station break. And coming up, 75 years of Japanese internment, our guests Bill Watanabe and Dr. Gerald Horn waiting to join us. Thank you.
I'm Elliot Gould, and you're listening to Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott, radio powered by the people.
And the song I Can by Nas. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check us out at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, please like and friend us on Facebook. Look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Venezuela, the Bolivarian nation of Venezuela. We are now going to turn our attention to the Japanese internment on February 19th, 1942, months after the attack on Pearl Harbor, and 75 years ago this year, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, signed an executive order for the evacuation, relocation, and internment of Japanese Americans, revoking their rights based solely on their Japanese ancestry. Between 110 and 120,000 people were forced into concentration camps, including both immigrants from Japan who were not considered U.S. citizens by law, and their children who were U.S. citizens by birth. A lot of people don't like to remember this forced relocation. And we're going to be discussing it today. Before bringing in our guests, I'd just like us to go to a short clip that gives us a rundown of that history of Japanese internment. Of course, this was during World War II.
FDR was in his third term as president when the war began. He had guided the nation through the Great Depression. No president was ever more powerful. On February 19, 1942, FDR signed Executive Order 9066. 9066 put the Secretary of War and his commanders in charge of deciding where the military zones would be and who should be removed. It gave the military power over the Attorney General to make these decisions without any hearings or due process. This was unprecedented power for a president, even for FDR. He asked Congress to support Executive Order 9066, and it did.
Congress followed that with Public Law 503, which then gave it power.
The laws did not specifically name any race or ethnic group, but allowed the military to impose restrictions on anyone it deemed a threat. But everyone knew who would be targeted. Military areas were created, and at first, curfews and other restrictions were imposed on everyone of Japanese descent. When the evacuation began on March 22, 1942, newsreels announced its start with a tone wavering between fear and contempt. This one, called Out They Go, never mentions that two-thirds of the evacuees were American citizens, but refers to them by a word we'd never use today.
Japs evacuate vital West Coast areas for the national security. At Los Angeles, 36,000 Japs see the handwriting on the wall and sell out their goods before their voluntary departure.
The evacuation wasn't voluntary, it was the law. And before it even began came mayhem, theft, and loss. People were only allowed to take to the camps what they could carry on their backs. They had to make arrangements to store or get rid of everything else they owned on short notice. The lucky ones got 2 weeks, some only a few days.
Most Japanese Americans had to leave their properties behind. There's lots of incidents when, you know, they were cheated or they weren't given full value for their property. There were a lot of fire sales that happened, so they had tremendous losses.
Tremendous losses. I'd like to welcome Bill Watanabe, founding executive director of the Little Tokyo Service Center, a multi-purpose social welfare agency in the Little Tokyo District in Los Angeles. And he has been the president of the Asian Pacific Policy and Planning Council, which is the largest social service network in the Asian community. Bill Watanabe, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Also on the line with us, Dr. Gerald Horn, our regular here. He holds the Morse Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, has published more than 30 books. Dr. Gerald Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Bill Watanabe, just your response. I mean, you really don't hear a hell of a lot about what happened with this quote-unquote relocation. I mean, it marks 75 years, and I'm sure that there's a lot of activity happening in Japanese-American communities, but the communities, the wider, broader community, don't really know a whole hell of a lot, and really the impact, not only on those who were forced into these camps, but on generations following?
Well, this is something that was kept fairly well hidden, like from history books and from schools. Even young school children that were educated here in California, say during the 50s, 60s, they never really read about it or heard about it. In the Japanese-American community, we have what we've been calling the Day of Remembrance, which is to commemorate the February the 19th. And we've been doing that every year for, gosh, I don't know how long, maybe the last 30 or 40 years. So we've been trying to let people know that this happened, it shouldn't be forgotten. And so every year we do have a commemoration. And this year, of course, was a very large one because of the 75th anniversary.
Right. And what are some of the stories people who have lived through this or the immediate generation follow? Just give our audience a little sense of what that was like, that internment was like for families.
Well, I guess both the being forced to have to leave right away, plus the internment itself. My family was living in the San Fernando Valley. They were farming there. And so they had a few weeks to try to make arrangements before they had to board a bus to go to Manzanar. My understanding is that people on Terminal Island, these are folks who are in the fishing business, they only had like 24 hours. Apparently, the FBI and the military swooped in because these people had fishing boats and radio equipment. I guess they thought these people might be more dangerous. I have heard stories where they were rousted in the middle of the night and forcibly taken away, put onto trains. These people didn't know where they were going. And this was in, I believe it was in either December or January of 41-42. And so, you know, they barely had time to pack, and when they got off the train, they were in Montana in the freezing cold, and they were hardly prepared for it. My family, they boarded a bus in Burbank, and the windows were darkened and blanked out, so they didn't know where they were headed. And when they got off in Manzanar, it was like the middle of nowhere at that time. So they spent about 2 years in Manzanar living in a barrack. Mm-hmm. My mother, I was born in January of 1944, so I was born right there in the camp. And then they issued this loyalty questionnaire to all of the internees, incarcerees, about their loyalty, which, of course, you can't really tell a person's loyalty from a questionnaire anyway. But my parents didn't answer the questions correctly. So we were sent to another camp called Tule Lake, which was a segregation center where they sent all the so-called troublemakers. And so Tule Lake truly was a concentration camp. I mean, there were armed guards, and if you got anywhere near the gate, the fences, you could have been shot dead. So that was my family's story, although we were quite fortunate because my family was able to pick up where they left off after the war.
Right. And of course, 34 years after this happened in 1976, President Gerald Ford issued an apology saying it was a setback to fundamental American principles. And then 12 years after that, with the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, Congress authorized payment of reparations, $20,000 for each surviving internee, about $40,000 in today's dollars when adjusted for inflation. But Dr. Gerald Horn, we just have a few minutes left here, but your take on this internment, but also the lessons you think we could learn for today.
Well, obviously, racism has to be stressed, but as Mr. Watanabe also suggested, there was an economic motivation behind this internment. That is to say that the Japanese-American community had established a formidable stronghold in the economy of the West Coast, stretching from Seattle to San Diego, particularly in agriculture, particularly in fishing. And when these families were interned, fundamentally what happened to their businesses is that they were bought up for a song by Euro-American merchants and Euro-American entrepreneurs. I think that the lesson is rather simple to draw, but difficult to execute. That is to say that obviously there needs to be an unremitting fight against the kind of white supremacy and racism that led to this outrage against civil liberties. And I think it also requires a certain kind of unity as well, because keep in mind that there was no unanimity of opinion as there is today with regard to the illegality and the outrageousness of this internment. That is to say that there were those who felt that they could profit handsomely from the misery implemented against this community. And then, of course, there were those who were reluctant to speak out because they thought that if they spoke out, they would face a similar fate. I'm afraid to say that in 2017, we're facing a similar issue.
Right. And Bill Watanabe, just a final thought from you on this, and also for people who want to be in touch with your organization and to learn more, the Little Tokyo Service Center, but also to learn more about all of this, your suggestions on what they could do. Just a final word from you, Bill Watanabe.
Well, what the professor said is exactly correct. When the war broke out, and of course it's wartime and there's hysteria and fear, but no one stood up for the Japanese-American community, nor for civil rights, except for the Quakers. Even the ACLU was somewhat on the sideline for a little while. So people need to speak out. People need to stand up for their constitutional rights, even if it's not their people. If it happens to anybody, people should be speaking out. There is a group called the Nikkei Civil, NCRR, Nikkei Civil Rights and Redress. They are one of the leading groups. And another group called Vigilant Love, they can look these up, that's doing a lot of work, especially with the Japanese and the Muslim communities, to work together to fight for civil rights in this day and age, because executive orders, if they're not challenged, they can just do whatever they want on the whim of one signature.
Right. And of course, this is a very frightening history of that internment. I mean, it's a lot of people, as many as 110 to 120,000 people. And given Islamophobia happening now, for example, we just want to make sure that this kind of thing must never happen again. And for people who want to be in touch with the Little Tokyo Service Center, is there a website or a place they can go to, Bill Watanabe?
Yes, there is a website, www.ltse.org. And from there, they can be directed to other civil rights groups as well.
Right. Well, on that note, we are going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Bill Watanabe and Dr. Gerald Horn. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are out of time. If you believe this, it went quickly. and today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank all of today's guests and the Sojourner Truth team, our intern, Sherelle Withers, assistant producer, Stephanie Case, and our engineer, Mr. T, Teddy Robinson. You can follow us on Twitter at So True Radio, and you can become our Facebook friend. Look for Sojourner Truth Radio, where you can follow our news coverage all day, also at www.sotrueradio.org. Audio is also available at archive.org. Search for Sojourner Truth, and of course on SoundCloud. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow for very special broadcasts. We have some very special broadcasts over the next few days. Sadly, I have to travel back east for a death in my family, but we have prepared some new shows for you, and we hope that you will tune in and enjoy it. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.